Welcome to On the Front Burner, where we give you a taste of important issues bubbling up in education and the world today.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Matt O'Donnell, Tech Innovation Specialist at the Sonoma County Office of Education. On this episode, we interview Tara Chiklowski, founder and CEO of Technovation, about coding education and why we need to rethink our approach to how we teach coding in schools. Tara, can you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the endeavors you've been involved in?
I've been formally trained as an aerospace engineer. And I actually haven't been involved in that many endeavors because I started the nonprofit. It was called Iridescent before. I had an opportunity to run a school in India before I came for my master's program to the U.S. And so I had some experience working, and it's my family that runs the school. So I had that experience going in, but it's basically been pretty much all of my adult life dedicated to this nonprofit.
You recently published an article in the journal about coding and how coding education has failed the students it was supposed to help most. And really, the article is not so much about coding, more about how we approach education in general. So can you talk a little bit about that article?
Yeah, I think we've been part of the coding movement and benefited from the attention, the funding that the industry and government has poured into trying to help children develop 21st century skills with a specific eye to technology skills. But sort of looking back at the past 10 years of work and resources and investment, I had a simple question: is what is the impact? And I think going into it, at least for us, the mindset was, can we bring in more diversity into this field? Can we empower students who are traditionally not part of this conversation or these communities? And so looking at the 2010 data, what I found was that, this is the NSF statistics, that 20% of the computer science undergraduates were women, 20.7%, and I think like 7 or 8% African-American. And then after 8 or 9 years of investment, the number of women's computer science undergraduates actually went down to 18.7%. And that was just totally shocking to me because our Technovation program empowers girls to find problems and all of that. And a lot of organizations I know are focused on increasing girls and minorities. And so I started to dig in the computer science education research, and you're completely right, like it applies even to broader, like not just technology. There were a couple of problems that were sort of surfacing. And the problems were that when you start with syntax or sort of the just the content knowledge part of it, that's not very motivating to a novice or a new learner. And it's not going to result in lasting changes in attitudes or interests or behavior, and because it lacks purpose. So everybody wants to know and be doing things that are focused on purpose. So that was interesting, that a lot of these coding programs that start with teaching you how to do JavaScript or Python are not fundamentally changing the number, that they're not helping these students become lifelong programmers or sort of builders with technology. The second was that a lot of these programs have focused on teaching you how to code, but not actually applying that tool set to a real problem. And so children know the syntax of coding, but are actually completely unable to apply it to any meaningful problem. So what good was that learning and teaching? And then lastly, especially for minority students and girls, there's attrition at every level because there's not enough social support. And anytime you bring in sort of people, it's less scalable, it's very messy, it's very unpredictable, so people don't like to invest in this. They rather invest in a video that'll get millions of views, it's very quantifiable, but guess what? It's not lasting impact. So these were the sort of three findings that were very, very interesting and, of course, apply broadly to education, right? And why are we teaching? What is the purpose of education? And I think it is to empower students to have a voice and agency in the world and to make the world better. So are we teaching, is the education system providing those tools? And I don't know. I mean, I think we have to take a hard look at that.
One of the things in the article you said is we were training students to become bricklayers, not architects. And I thought that was an interesting line. And the way forward was to have students solve real world problems. And in order to do that, we need to get together lots of different organizations to figure out what types of problems kids are capable of solving at different ages. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ideas you had?
I mean, we're dealing with a complex system, right? Like the world is a complex system and we are not taught it that way, which is why we have so many problems to begin with. Like, right, that's why we are in the climate crisis, because we as a society, we focus just on one thing, which was increasing productivity. And so the world is deeply interconnected and we don't teach it that way. And I think the education system is also pretty narrow in that regard, right? Like, where it's just a sort of content knowledge. And looking around, I think if you were to, like, I think we have a very good understanding of what book 8-year-old should be reading or what type of math problem a 10-year-old should be practicing. But we don't have a sense of what type of real-world problem a 6-year-old should be practicing or a 12-year-old should be practicing or an 18-year-old. But somehow when they enter the workforce, we throw at them very complex interconnected problems and then hope that they magically come up with creative solutions, right? But if you're not been building these skills for decades, then it's the likelihood of them being creative, innovative individuals is low. And so the idea was that there are a couple of strands. So I think technical content knowledge, of course, is one whole area. So that would be computer science or computational thinking or computational action. And another layer that I think about is problem identification. What is a good problem? There are very few entrepreneurs in the world. There are very few inventors, because most people like to be given a concrete problem. We like KPIs. We like quarterly goals and targets. But when we're given a blank canvas, we completely freeze because we don't know how to go forward. So I think teaching children, like, how do you work with a blank canvas, is a very important skill. And so finding out meaningful problems, the gap that there is that an individual can fill because of her unique perspectives, is an important matching process. Then design thinking, which I think is pretty prevalent in schools. Another layer, this is the third layer, is team science or collaboration, where you try to figure out, well, what are your values? What are your team's values? How do you come together? What is a common goal? How do you negotiate? How do you make decisions? All of these things, sort of like leadership or working together. And another layer that I think about is problem identification. What is a good problem? There are very few entrepreneurs in the world. There are very few inventors, because most people like to be given a concrete problem. We like KPIs. We like quarterly goals and targets. But when we're given a blank canvas, we completely freeze because we don't know how to go forward. So I think teaching children, like, how do you work with a blank canvas, is a very important skill. And so finding out meaningful problems, the gap that there is that an individual can fill because of her unique perspectives, is an important matching process. Then design thinking, which I think is pretty prevalent in schools. Another layer, this is the third layer, is team science or collaboration, where you try to figure out, well, what are your values? What are your team's values? How do you come together? What is a common goal? How do you negotiate? How do you make decisions? All of these things, sort of like leadership or working together, we again kind of hope that people or adults sort of naturally figure it out. But there's enough research out there to show that we can make this process less painful. And I think schools are already beginning to have social emotional curriculum. I think we can add these skills and strategies in with a particular eye to working together for real world problem solving. The fourth layer, I think, is metacognition, where understanding yourself, where you get frustrated, what is your how does your interest ebb and wane and grow with the content, with your environment. I mean, this is just self-awareness that I think people, when we reach middle age, we get that. But again, with the right kind of structure and guidance, I think children can begin to develop this sort of metacognitive ability. And lastly is complex systems thinking. So I think there's a lot of work done in the field of climate and resilience that we can learn from and begin to give children practice on how, when you think about a system, think about all the inputs. And if you change one thing and you move one lever, what are the other things that move? So I think that I've been looking at a lot of research in this area, and they're amazing, like, researchers, but these fields are completely siloed, completely separated, and don't typically intersect with sort of STEM education best practices. And I think there's room there for collaboration. So my vision is, like, yeah, ideally we bring together these experts and we keep refining and creating this curriculum, make it really robust, and then basically develop a set of standards for real-world problem solving, just like we have literacy and numeracy standards.
One of the things in education is assessment. We assess things that we think are valuable, and then lots of money and lots of time gets spent on that. And as we know, math and ELA are two things that are assessed pretty heavily, where real world problem solving less so, even though there's been a move towards assessing that more so. In your article, you talked a little bit about a need for new assessments. Can you talk about what that might look like?
I'm not so sure it's new. It's just, again, borrowing from some other fields. There is some work done in measuring women's empowerment. And I like that framework. It's called a capability-based measurement, where you concretely measure the increase in resources, voice, influence, agency, and achievements because of a particular intervention. And of course, this means that it's after the fact, which makes it harder. But if you are planning for a longer term intervention, which you should be, then it may not be that hard to do. So I think I like that because it aligns with sort of the UN 2030 agenda for prosperity for all, for the planet, and a more systems thinking view where education should contribute to a person's overall well-being, right? And well-being is defined as increased resources, of course, your own agency, as well as how you're recognized in society. So I think that could be, that is one framework. But then, of course, from an education point of view, we also want to know, well, can you do some parts of this better, right? So one concrete way would be to actually review the prototype or the solution that students create to tackle a problem and to see how innovative, how useful it is. So that is subjective, because of course humans are reviewing it, but it could be a year-to-year measure of the impact of the program.
In your article, you also talk about the changing careers that students are going to face once they graduate, and how algorithms and AI are going to take away some of the jobs that we may be training people for. Can you talk a little bit about the impact AI is going to have on the careers of the future?
I mean, it's having an impact now, right? Like, for instance, I use Google Calendar's features to figure out when I should have my meetings, because it automatically helps with scheduling, right? Like, and so I think there's an article that also talks about like current AI-based grammar and sort of numeracy programs outperform like 80 or 90% of adults in the developed world, and that it's not surprising, right? So I think it's a very fast-moving field, and the only thing that we can do is to basically teach children and adults, because we have 40, 50 years ahead of us. And the only thing that we can do is to basically teach this sort of metacognitive ability where you're constantly evaluating the environment, the gaps, and then constantly evaluating your own strengths, your own interests, and be doing this matching process where you're trying to see, well, what value do I have to add to this environment? And I think that without that type of a dynamic approach, we are just setting ourselves up for failure. If you're going to say, well, the jobs of in 10 years are going to have this type of skills. I think more and more complex systems is going to be key. And you can already see this happening. So when a lot of the media picked up on algorithmic bias, it was very interesting to see how quickly the industry responded. And ethics has become such a key part of the AI discussion. But honestly, if we were thinking and looking at it from a systems point of view in the first place, then this would not have happened, right? Where you don't just deploy a product without thinking about all the human elements and pieces of this. So I think that if anything, complex systems thinking is going to be vital and has to sort of be brought into the K-12 system. So we're giving children, it's just a very normal way of looking at things rather than very, very siloed views.
And what role do you think NGOs or nonprofits or the government has to play in creating that type of system?
I I think children spend like 20% of their time in the formal school classroom sort of environment. But I think schools play a very key role as anchors for the community. And I think learning has to become very fluid across all these boundaries. Like, it's not just formal and informal, especially like with the bringing in social media and technology and phones and parents and all these different groups. And so I think the boundaries are very porous. But the system still, there has to be some top-down and bottom-up type of approach, right? So individuals, parents should definitely ask for these types of more relevant skills to be taught. But then I think governments and education systems need to be revamping their curriculum to offer these types of programs. And then I think NGOs always fill this gap between what industry can offer and what the government takes on, right? So NGOs, in my mind, are sort of innovating at the fringes and filling in the gaps. And I think they play a critical role here because I can see education, like the formal school system, taking a very long time to adapt standards and deploy them. But nonprofit, like the after-school environment, the NGO sector, can step in like they did with the coding movement and drove a lot of awareness. I think they can do the same thing here.
And what would that look like in your role? I know you work around providing different activities for people in STEM education and STEM environments. What would that look like in doing creative problem solving if it wasn't surrounding coding or digital tools?
I think just the process of empowering people to spend time, not like an hour or so, but actually significant amount of time spread out over a couple of months, finding a problem in their community, which also helps them sort of think civically, and then working together as a team, as a family, to go through the full sort of iteration cycle and deploying it outside into the real world, which gives them a sense of that complex system. I think that whole process, the traditional sort of entrepreneur's journey, is life-changing. And I think we know these systems, we know these programs and these models work. I think doing this at a large scale is what we need because, I mean, children who are in school today are going to enter the workforce as adults in 2030. And the world of 2030 is going to have even more complex problems. And we are not doing anything today to prepare children for those kinds of complex problems. So I feel that there's a real urgency for NGOs and educators and volunteers and mentors to bring these kinds of programs that are real-world problem-solving in a team environment to their communities.
What advice would you give to an organization that wanted to help this to make sure it was done equitably?
I think that's a very good question. I think it takes a lot of effort and dedication to bring resources to groups that don't have them. And I think if you come at it with humility and respect, but don't give up because it doesn't work quickly and easily. It'll take many cycles and it takes a lot of money to be able to try this many, many times. But my really sort of biggest piece of advice would be don't give up. It may take 3 to 5 years to work and have success in a community that is under-resourced, but it is vital that they see your dedication, and it takes time to build that trust. And without us trying, we will not be able to build an equitable environment.
And what is the focus of your nonprofit, and what are some of the successes you've had with it?
Our mission is to empower underrepresented groups, underserved groups, to develop a sense of agency that they can tackle problems in their communities. There's a specific focus on engineering and technology. I mean, success is on multiple levels, but it also feels like there's so much more to do that I'm always hesitant to use the word success. I think one is just sort of staying alive, very basic. It's not easy. There are so many nonprofits that And I have seen, like, so many of my colleagues, they wrap up, they fold the organization after 7-10 years because it's hard. It's an entrepreneur's journey and it's hard. And being able to stay relevant to what the environment needs is a real test. So you will not get funded if you've not stayed relevant. And so I would say it doesn't sound very glamorous, but being able to grow and thrive and get stronger over time is an indicator of success, of being relevant.
You said you ran a school in India. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the differences between education in India and education in the United States? And what could we in the United States learn from education in India?
That's a great question. So I think the U.S. education system does a couple of things really well. I think one is focusing on giving each child agency and project-based learning, and I think social-emotional learning that is coming up. And I think a lot of structure, from an outsider's point of view, I see on problem-solving and entrepreneurship. I think America does have an ecosystem of awesome entrepreneurs. And I would say some credit should be given to the education system. So I think that is something very cool. I think in terms of the Indian education system, I think there's a lot of emphasis on content knowledge, which I personally went through the Indian education system, and that wasn't great. But interestingly, and I don't know whether it's a function of the Eastern culture, there's less emphasis on an individual's happiness, right? Like in America, there's a very constant sort of refrain of do what makes you happy. And I think sometimes that sends us down the wrong path, because I'm not sure happiness or striving for happiness is the most important thing. Maybe striving for fulfillment and contentment and coexisting harmoniously with the other parts, other species in the world could be also meaningful goals. So I think the American school system and culture emphasizes the individual a lot, which is why, of course, the positive side is entrepreneurs. But there's something to be learned from the Indian system where the collective is more important than the individual. And I think focusing on the process helps you be more persistent, right? So if you're not constantly asking yourself, well, am I happy right now? You are more able to go through long, tedious tasks, which in life, anything that's hard is going to require persistence, right? And I think that's something that the Indian education system teaches. Not, I think, explicitly, but just because the content can be boring.
So if you were to give some advice to a teacher that's in a pretty traditional system where most of the other classes are teaching content, what advice would you give to that teacher to get them started in getting students more prepared for their future?
I would say there's always room in the curriculum to open it up and to engage students in basically finding a problem that they care about and going through the problem identifications. And we have, I mean, I don't want to publicize our organization, but all our curriculum is completely free online, and it provides a pretty good framework to follow. It's over 10 weeks. You can go through the problem identification, design thinking, iteration process. And I have volunteered in classes many times, and I've seen that students, their attention drops. It's impossible to be constantly focused on learning for the full 6 hours. And so when you open up time to do this kind of real world problem solving or problem like team based work, and if you leave like a couple of hours or 1 hour at least, even in the day, the other learning, and when children know that they need to get through the other content and focus so that they can focus on this part. They're actually much more engaged and actively involved in the learning. So I would say it's totally possible to do. There is time in the curriculum, and there are the resources and lesson plans that we have, but I would say just try. There's nothing to lose. You'll find that your students will be so engaged and excited.
And can you share with everyone where they can go to find those resources?
Yes, technovation.org. And you can also email me directly. I would be happy. You can put my email as tara@technovation.org. I'd be happy to share the direct links to the curriculum. But if you go to our website, you'll learn more about the programs, the ages, and you'll be able to access. You just have to register and you can access all the lesson plans, the educator materials, as well as the curriculum for the students.
Tara, thank you so much for joining us today. And we look forward to hearing more from you and learning more about your endeavors as you move forward.
Thank you, Matt. It was a real pleasure, and your questions were very good. So, and thank you for reaching out. I mean, it's only through people like you that we keep improving. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to On the Front Burner. This podcast was produced by the Sonoma County Office of Education.